Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm your host, Dave Marshall, and this is the second part of our interview on nomenclature with Dr. Marcus Bertling. Now, obviously, if you've not yet listened to the first part of this interview, then that would be the best place for you to start. We had a great discussion as to what you can and can't call an animal, and now in this second part, we look at how the code applies to the fossil record, and we analyse the particularly interesting case of Scrotum humanum. And as you all know by now, the images that accompany this episode are available on our website, and likes, shares, and reviews all really help the show out. So, we hope you enjoy this episode. So turning our attention now to the fossil record, are modern and fossil animals governed by the same rules? You mentioned before about type specimens.
Yes, absolutely. There is no rule telling us that that the fossil world has their own names independent of the modern world, for instance, or that a fossil species has a different type of types than a modern species has. That's just the same rules for all of them.
Can you give us an overview of the different types of type fossil? Because you'll hear a lot of people when discussing paleontology maybe talking about a holotype or a paratype or something like that. What are the different types?
Well, the types that we talk about colloquially usually refer to what is called the name-bearing type in nomenclature. And the name-bearing type is always from the hierarchy one below. So that means if you have a genus, you take the type from one of the species within this genus. And if you have a species, you have to take the type from a single individual. And this is then the type. And for a family, of course, you take one genus as the type. And nowadays we have as primary types, or what could be called a primary type, only two possibilities. That is the holotype. Holos means whole. It's one specimen as a type for a species, or we have several syntypes. Syn means together, that have previously also been called co-types. In those instances where expressly no holotype is fixed. So these are syntypes. And for some single-celled organisms within recent Rosaria and Herbaria, we also have the hapantotypes as ontogenetic series, but that's not relevant for us as paleontologists. Then we have the type series to mention here. These are specimens of an original species author, where these authors have not designed neither a holotype nor declared a syntype. So that is a type series for the time being. And from that type series, you can secondarily select a type. So primary types, if you talk about species, are just holotypes or syntypes, one holotype or several syntypes together. And secondarily, we basically come up with what is called the lectotypes. Lecto means selected or taken from, taken from the syn types or the type series later from another author, or maybe even the same author who might have changed his or her mind. That is the one possibility. Or if holotype or syn types have been lost, subsequent authors could also establish neotypes. Neos means new, but only in the case of loss. That is, for instance, necessary after this devastating fire in the National Museum of Brazil, where hundreds of holotypes have been lost, and scientists from that region are eager to establish neotypes for the species there. So this is the what we in nomenclature consider the two types, but there are other words around that could suggest to the one who is not that familiar with the system that there are types as well. For instance, the paratypes. These are no name-bearing types. These are just the remaining specimens of the type series after somebody has later picked a lectotype from them. So these are the individuals that stand beside para, the proper type. Then we have the things like topotype, which means only the specimens come from the same locality as the holotype, or the stratotype, that means the specimen comes from the same stratigraphic horizon as the holotypes. None of these have any value in the nomenclatural meaning that they can be used as specimen to convey some meaning what the original author has meant. So we just have holotypes, syntypes, and lectotypes and neotypes. That is all we get. Two of them primary and two of them secondary types, and forget about the rest. So it's a bit irritating at first, but it's not that complicated in the end.
Yeah, each have their place and usage. But yeah, in general, what's the purpose of having a type?
The purpose of having types is unanimity. You have to refrain to some reference organism, in the case of species, or a reference species in the name of a genus, that later generations can tell what the original author has meant. For instance, nowadays, much species are delimited by their genetic inventory. So on a routine basis, zoologists perform genetic analyses. And for this, it is extremely important to have types of modern, of course, animals properly deposited somewhere and accessibly deposited, so that type individuals can be selected and the same genetic analyses can be formed on them as well. And only against this background, we can understand what the original authors maybe in the 19th century was talking about, without even thinking of genetic analysis as a taxonomic tool that we have now. And so establishing types is important, but at least as important for museums and curators is to properly care, to properly take care of these types, to keep them accessible to the community.
Okay, one of the most famous cases in paleontology is that of Scrotum humanum, which the first dinosaur ever figured in a publication. Can you tell us about this case and why it is that we don't, instead of calling Megalosaurus Megalosaurus, why we don't call it scrotum.
Yeah, that's quite funny, and it's complicated and funny. Perhaps that's why it is so well known. That the history goes back to the 17th century, even. An author named Plot figured the distal end of a Megalosaurus thigh bone, a femur, from the Jurassic of Oxfordshire, and almost 100 years people forgot about that figure. It hasn't been named. In 1763, Brooks refigured it, compared it to an elephant, and in an isolated caption on a table, he called it Scrotum Humanum. Again, that was forgotten about. Megalosaurus was coined and established and helsted in 1970, remarkably in the Journal of Insignificant Research, pointed out that problem, that there is an older synonym, Scrotum Humanum, for Megalosaurus. Following that, again, after more than 20 years, Bill Sargent in 1993 applied to the commission that Scrotum Humanum be declared as an unavailable name. But the commission did not accept that application because the idea of the commissioners was that the name was not meant taxonomically. It was just meant as a comparison of the peculiar shape of the distal end, because there was no description coming along with it. In addition, it certainly is what we call a nomen oblitum, a forgotten name. But for some reason that I don't understand, Scrotum Humanum is not on the official index of rejected and invalid specific names. Probably because, or perhaps because, the idea is that it was not meant as a taxon name, just as a comparison. If you could, in nowadays in our language, we say, "Well, that looks like a bucket on somebody's head," and we could call it bucket head. In those days, people were writing in Latin, and so they would have written Buckethead in Latin. My Latin is not that good to easily transfer that. And perhaps 200 years later, somebody would wonder whether that would be meant, would have been meant as a name. So that is probably the way of thinking why we call Megalosaurus Megalosaurus. One point is, it has fallen into oblivion. It hasn't been used for more than 100 years after establishment. And the other one is, it's probably not meant as a name, or hasn't been meant as a name by the original author.
So for anyone wondering what it actually looks like, if you've not seen it, if you imagine a cartoon bone and then chop it off just at the very end, just so it looks like, yeah, a pair of scrotum. Yeah, that was it. Scrotum Humanum.
Yeah, you probably find it on Wikipedia. It's that famous. I wonder whether Wikipedia has an entry for that. Could well be. But we could perhaps reproduce it here. It's in the Biodiversity Heritage Library as well. I've once looked that up before, so that is free to reproduce.
And another thing I got from that was the Journal of Insignificant Research, was that?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Wow.
Yeah.
Is that still going?
Oh, I don't know.
I hope so.
That needs to be checked.
I could be their number one author.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway, right, on to other fossils. So trace fossils, your trackways, prints, bite marks, whatever, they're another complication on this, since they are fossilized behaviors. So how does the ICZN handle trace fossils when one animal can make a whole number of different traces?
Well, that's a problem of taxonomy, in this case, ichnotaxonomy mainly, how to or where to draw the lines and how to handle these problems. But ICZN treats trace fossil names as all other names. And the zoological code even includes non-animal traces as well. For instance, microborings done by cyanobacteria or chlorophytes that should normally be within the microorganism code or the botanical code. But both codes have been historically reluctant to include trace fossils. They wouldn't deal with them. And so we now have, since the last issue, or since the current issue, actually, we have all organism traces and not just animal traces in the zoological code, which is perfect because at least in ichnology, in trace fossil science, the nomenclature is governed by the same rules. And the ruling doesn't switch when an organism, when a trace fossil is known to be made by, say, a worm instead of an algae.
Okay, but with behaviors, say I'm running along the beach, leaving footprints, that's one kind of trace. I then decide to try and run along on my hands. That would be another type. I'd fall over, lie down flat on my back, and that's the whole print of my body. But they morph one into another. So how do you divide it up? Or would that be a whole separate name for that running into running on your hands into falling over trace?
Yes, that's again not a nomenclatural problem, but a problem of ichnotaxonomy. And a couple of years ago, colleagues and I have drawn the lines there. We have distinguished between compound and composite trace fossils. And a compound trace fossil may receive its a name on its own, and the demand or the criterion behind it would be that the same organism synchronously produces different traces. For instance, a bivalve burrowing or digging with its foot at the same time and to the sediment below, and fiddling with its sypho to the surface upwards. And that could produce different traces at the same time by the same individual. That would be a compound trace, and that receives a name on its own. But if you have a trilobite first walking gently and then starting to dig, making cruciana, and then resting down in the end, making rusophicus, these are traces that are as in very much in the example that you just quoted. Not formed synchronously, one after each other, and so this is a composite trace, and each part of these composite trace receive their own names. So one is the walking, one is the bulldozing, and one is the resting trace, and we have names for all of them.
Similar to how the zoological code would look at fossil and modern animals, does the code distinguish between fossil and recent traces? Does it deal with modern traces?
No, it explicitly does not cover modern traces. It is restricted to fossil traces. It does not define fossil, unfortunately. And this is an open question for debate, at least in ichnology, because some traces, modern traces, have already been named. These recent traces that have been named are borings. So they are within rocks, hard substrate, but this hard substrate is evidently modern. And so the question is, where do we draw the line between modern and recent? Do we say anything older than Holocene is a fossil? Or do we say anything older than Quaternary is a fossil? Or do we say anything that is below the taphonomically active zone is a fossil? I wonder whether there is a definition of fossil as an adjective or a fossil as a noun. I'm still looking for a good way to solve this problem within the next edition of the code. I'm quite sure that we need a definition of the term fossil there to prevent modern traces to be named. I mean, they're all too ephemeral. You could use your example of running along the beach, take a photograph or cast it with plaster of Paris and have the types there. If modern traces are allowed, of course, nobody would like that. Or you take a bee's nest or you take a bird's nest and attach a name to it, a modern, of course. And, of course, this will all disintegrate within a couple of months or years, even without any taphonomically active process taking place there. But we need a line to be drawn between fossil and recent. But I personally, I don't have an idea how to do that waterproof. And perhaps that is a call also to the listeners, a call for input. How do we define fossil or a fossil?
I'm sure people have thoughts on this. So write them in. Comments, social media, Twitter, get it all in. It'd be interesting to hear what you come up with. You were mentioning that it'd be good to have an idea for this for the next edition of the code. Is the code set in stone, or does it continually get revised?
No, it's certainly not set in stone. We are currently using the fourth edition, and the next is being prepared right now. The idea is to have a first draft that is to be presented to the community next year. There's ample time of discussion in the various scientific subgroups that has to go on there. So maybe 23 or something, we could see the fifth edition of the code that then considers the different means of electronic publication that we have nowadays. The problem with taxon names established in supplementary data only electronically in journals that are produced as printed journals as well, and all that that is not included in the current code, but we need some lines to deal with that. So, and that will continue in irregular times and spaces that will happen, that we see the next edition of the code.
Do you find, in generally speaking, that academics are adhering to the code as well as they could be? Do you encounter a lot of mistakes?
I think most people do their very best. The code is, in some issues, difficult to comprehend, but you usually know colleagues that know better, that are familiar with the code. And you can turn to members of the commission, to commissioners, and ask on the website of the commission, which is izzn.org. You find a list of commissioners with their specialties, and you could ask them their questions. And if they don't know, this happens quite frequently, this commissioner colleague will use our internal newsletter and ask the other colleagues, hey, I have been confronted with a problem that I cannot solve. How do we interpret the code in this special instance? And sometimes very fierce or very philosophical discussions develop from that. And we see, the code is still anything but perfect. So there's plenty of things to adjust in the future that have gone unnoticed as yet.
Yeah, are there many ways in which the code falls short? Specifically in its treatment of paleontology, are there any glaring issues that it just can't seem to work through?
Not to my knowledge, actually. The only problem I know is perhaps an enormous trace fossil that cannot be collected, where you can only take a photo or a cast it with plaster of Paris and take that cast to your museum or to your institution and deposit this. But that would not be the holotype. It is only a cast of the holotype or a photo of the holotype. Currently, this is not accepted within the code. That is the only instance that I can think of the code could be improved for the demands of paleontology.
Is that a dinosaur trackway? Is this even published?
That could be a dinosaur track. I mean, the individual imprint is the one in invertebrate ichnology that the names are based on. That usually gets collected this way is accessible and is available as a holotype. This was just a theoretical example.
Right, okay.
So I'm not aware of any concrete case, any certain case where this has caused a problem. So this was just thinking forward.
You got me all excited there about this giant trace fossil, uncollectible by paleontologists.
Yeah, it could be, say, a bed that is a meter thick and you have a footprint on top of it, 50 by 50 or so. I certainly couldn't remove it from the field. And so it perhaps remains uncollected for these pragmatic reasons.
I think in that instance, we would probably build the museum around it.
Yes.
So just to wrap up now, to conclude, do you feel that more should or could be done to raise awareness of the work of the ICZN in the public?
Yes, there certainly can be done more, but I think bad taxonomy, that is bad science, is much more the serious problem than unawareness of the rules of nomenclature. People that coin names easily without studying all available literature are much more nuisance, if you ask me, than people that are not familiar with the code. So I think that people, as I said, do their best to adhere to the code. The ones that coin names at least do. And the channels to help them, I think, are at least open. And we offer our support for colleagues who are in demand. And so perhaps the problem is not that much one of awareness, but rather of, say, not awareness of the nomenclature rules, but awareness of science, scientific procedures. You know, how reproducible are your results, if you coin a name? That, to my mind, is more important. So bad taxonomy is more important than bad nomenclature.
Okay, and finally, of all the world's animals, alive, dead, or behaviors, which taxon name is your favorite? Is music to your ears?
I like the species names that are either very short as appositions, for instance, Rex or Audax or Bufo. And I like names that have a regular a change between vowels and consonants. They are very easily pronounceable, and maybe three or four syllables. That is euphonious to me, with a perhaps prominent proportion of dark vowels like A, O, U, rather than the light and somewhat itchy E and I vowels. But I mean, the Linnaean names, the tautonomy where the species has the same name as the genus, that is very nice. Bufo bufo, corvus corvus, that is funny, I think. It's no longer permissible today, but in Linnaean times it was permissible. But a Tyrannosaurus Rex, that is just a great name. And that's why it's so popular, because it has a beautiful genus name and it has a beautiful species name. So I can follow that way of thinking and naming very well.
Okay, Marcus, well, that's been absolutely fascinating. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, pleasure. It was a fun interview, and I enjoyed the views that you have on my bit of this science world. Thanks, Dave.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall and Liz Martin Silverstone, with contributions from Tom Fletcher, Vish Venkat, and Elsa Pancharoli. Music was composed by Patrick Kendall Smith. Paleocast was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on funding from you, the listeners. So, if you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programs, and follow us across social media platforms to get all the latest news. Finally, if you enjoy our podcast, then please explore all of our video content on YouTube and follow our other projects, the Virtual Natural History Museum and the Paleocast Gaming Network. You are not allowed to name something genus and species the same.
No longer, yes. At some point, I think it was 1931 in the first edition of the code, that was prohibited.
I can't believe we got through this whole interview with me thinking that you could basically do whatever you wanted with any name, and then right at the very end, you just say, oh, you can't do this.
Okay, yeah,
genus and species. Name the same, you can't do it anymore.
Sorry.